on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
Sitting in the video village, at one point, I looked over at my husband, and we're both like teary because they're saying on the screen words from the book. You just can't imagine how that feels. Well, you probably can, but it's so much fun to see that.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers, no more barriers, no one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello, it's Friday. It is The Self-Publishing Show. Welcome along. It's me, James Blatch.
And me, Mark Dawson. Hello.
Let us welcome our Patreon supporters before we do anything else, because it should be the first thing we do every week. We love people coming along, becoming a part of our family here and supporting the show and getting some goodies in return. So our patrons this week, we have Kaylee Urbaniak and Benjamin Bruis and also Kit Ward. All good author names, I would say. Do you think they're real names?
Why wouldn't they be? I'm sure they are, James. Is Blatch a real name? I don't know any other Blatches.
Yeah, well, I don't think you'd make up the name Blatch, but Kaylee Urbaniak, she'll be in touch. Might be he, but I think she will be in touch, I'm sure, to let us know. But anyway, good. Welcome along. They've been to patreon.com/self-publishing show. Okay, Mark, we should say also straight away that as we speak, Ads for Authors is open for a short period of enrollment. First time in more than 6 months, I think, probably just over 6 months since we opened it last. And that's been a long time, but there you go, chance to get on board for 2021. Just quickly tell us what the course is and does.
Well, I suppose the clue is in the name. So, Advertising for Authors. It's Facebook ads, Amazon ads, BookBub ads, and then lots of little bits and pieces that you'll need to know in order to make those platforms work. So things like ad design, blurbs, other bits and bobs. There's a lot of content. I mean, the Facebook course itself is, I think, probably over 30 hours long now. The Amazon Ads course, which has been tweaked and updated a bit, is written and presented by Janet Margo, Janet worked at Amazon setting up the books program. So that's, you know, there isn't really a course on the market from an Amazonian, that's for sure. And because we like having people who know the platforms inside out doing the courses, we've got BookBub themselves doing the BookBub ads course, which is going to be, again, I think the best on the market when it comes to using BookBub ads, not the email ads, but the ads that appear at the bottom of the emails. That's another exciting addition. And those three platforms together, those are pretty much at the moment the only ones you need to know. And you probably only really need to know one or two of them to get things moving. But all of those platforms are covered, and the intention is that it should be everything you ever need to know about advertising will be in that course. Because, you know, as you know, we took the probably slightly foolish decision 4 years ago saying that everyone who has ever signed up gets all updates for free, and we continue to add to the course. And that might be going to BookBub and saying, you know, we need to update our BookBub course because it's not good enough. We want to make it better. And then BookBub jump in and take care of that for us. Or, you know, taking the Amazon course that I did originally, which I think may still be available. I think we've kept that course up. Mm. So you can look at how I do it, which is a little different from how Janet does it. But Janet is, you know, knows more about that platform than I do. So there's a lot of content, and, you know, it's still a course that we're all really proud of.
Yeah, I think it's a fair way of doing it. We it's a big investment. Once you've got it, it's yours for life. Everything that gets added, you get as well. And I just think it enables authors to make a good decision for the future. It's like an investment for their career that goes on for years rather than just a few weeks when they do that one course maybe that's live at the time. Certainly was the case, and we're more than happy for that to be the case. And now is a good time. It's, you know, it's been a ridiculously crazy 12 months or so, coming up to 12 months. Yeah, something did happen. It's now normal to be in the middle of a pandemic. We're right in the middle of it again in the UK. Figures looking worse than they ever have at any point. Hospitals close to being overwhelmed. Everyone's in their house, or should be, in their houses now. And yet the other side of that is that digital industries, online retailers, organizations like Amazon, for instance, and Netflix and others have done very well during this period because there's been a change of, I guess, of priorities, people being at home and wanting to read and watch films. It's been a great time for lots of authors have done very well. And that's a dual thing. And it's a good point you made, actually, in one of your emails I was looking at this week, Mark, is that it's not just the fact that people are at home wanting to read books, but from an indie author point of view, millions of dollars have been taken out of the advertising market. So we are seeing cheap leads, cheap advertising, and it's been as cheap as it's been for a long time to reach readers.
Yeah, so you've got any store, and there's just a very large lorry just going past the window over there, so you might hear that. Apologies, listeners. But yeah, you've got big stores, like let's say Walmart isn't advertising so much at the moment. I'm not sure that's the best example in the States, but Tesco's over here, any of the supermarkets, they're not really going to be pushing too much in the way of advertising because their stores are either not open or they're limited in what they're selling right now. W.A. Smith's, as I think I mentioned last week, where my book is, no one can buy it at the moment because the store's shut. So there's not much point in advertising to sell those products because people aren't going into the stores. Now, Facebook and Amazon still have the same amount of ad inventory, the same eyeballs that they can serve the ads to. And because these all work on an auction basis, those big multinational ad budgets now being withdrawn because there's not much point in advertising means that the eyeballs that are available are now cheaper to access than they were before, just through, you know, lack of competition or less competition. So it is a good time. I'm definitely seeing Facebook especially is cheap at the moment. It's a good time to be advertising.
Well, think of the millions spent by the travel industry normally in advertising, including online advertising, live events, anything like that.
Anything just that you can't do. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of industries that are not as fortunate as ours and are shuttered and have been for ages. There's not much, there's no point at all in those industries advertising for things they can't sell. So we don't have that problem because you know, I was going to say I could download your book in, you know, with a couple of clicks. Obviously, I can't do that because you still haven't written it. But I could download Lucy Scores' book, for example, and then have that on the device within a minute. And that's great for us.
You could download, if you're watching on YouTube, Barbara Hinsky's book, Guiding Emily, with a
very nice,
absolutely lovely front cover.
Segue.
And the reason I've what a segue. Well, the reason I've got this book is because Barbara is our interviewee today. So we're going to move on to hearing from Barbara. So yeah, this is her latest book, Guiding Emily. I bought it for my wife because we brought up a guide dog puppy in the house, and that's the center of this story.
And your daughter's called Emily.
And my daughter's called Emily, who does require guiding. Yes, this is partly, I think, a sort of charitable effort from Barbara as well, because she's involved in the organizations in the States provide dogs. Barbara is a former attorney. I'm trying to think what else. It's a while, actually, since we recorded this interview, but it was very, very enjoyable. She does very well. She has a knack of getting the business side of things right. And it's all very well being a good writer. That is important. Of course it is, but you do have to be a business person to one degree or another. You need to run an organization, even if it's just you and your books. And Barbara is, I think, perhaps because in America, being an attorney might not be quite the same as being a lawyer in the UK. It's quite a business, an aggressive business there. So they're quite a lot of business acumen as well as the legal side of things. And I think Barbara's brought that into her career. So including when she heard a friend of a friend might be connected with Hallmark, having a conversation that led on to something really amazing, which you're going to hear about in this interview. So without further ado, let us hear from Barbara Hinsky.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Barbara Hinsky. I failed at the first attempt. Barbara Hinsky is your author name, but I'm going to call you Barb because that's how I think people call you, Barb.
Yes.
Welcome to The Self-Publishing Show, Barb.
Thank you. It's quite an honor and a thrill to be here.
Hey, well, we're excited to have you here. I think we're going to get into some details in the interview, but I know that you were one of our early course participants, and we've been delighted to see your success. So we're going to talk about the Rosemont series. We're going to talk about you. I think let's start at the beginning. Before you were writing, I think you were a lawyer.
Yes, like Mark, I was a lawyer, you know, slaving away in the trenches and doing a lot of writing, but contracts. I was in the business side of law.
So you were writing contracts rather than romances.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Nothing creative about it, really.
Not quite the same thing. And writing for you was something that was just in the back of your mind, or you'd had a dabble in the past at some point?
You know, I hadn't had a dabble, and I didn't even think that I could write. My undergraduate degree was actually in engineering. I was an industrial engineer, so I had a technical side to me. And when I started practicing law, the partners said, oh my goodness, this woman can't write. We need to get her tutored. And before somebody really looked at how much they were spending, I had spent 2 years in learning, being privately tutored by the dean of the local law school. So I learned how to become a very good technical writer. And then I thought, okay, well, maybe I can write. And then my dad retired and sat at home and wrote murder mysteries, wrote whodunits for 17 years until he passed away. He never tried to publish them, never sent them to an agent.
Wow.
But he was kind of an inspiration. And when he died, I read those manuscripts and it just sort of sparked something in me. I thought, well, you know, I have a voice. I'd like to do this.
Did you ever do anything with your father's manuscripts?
No, I always thought when I retired that I would. And in fact, just this weekend, I dug them out again. And it was like a wonderful visit with my dad. I'll tell you, it was wonderful. I spent a lot of time in tears. But I don't think that was, he died in 2000 and fiction is different.
Yeah.
Now. And I don't think I can turn them around. And I don't think I want to. They're what they need to be. And I have now my own significant voice. And like a lot of us on this podcast, I have far more ideas than I have time to put them into paper. So
yeah,
that's where I'm settled.
So inspired by your father, and after he passed away, I can see that motivation. It's a strong motivation as well. So where were you working? You were still working as a lawyer at this point when you thought you might give it a go?
Yeah, I was still working as a lawyer. I started writing in 2011, late in 2010, I broke my neck in a car accident. And I was in one of those horrid neck braces and I had double vision for months. Still have a little bit of it at times, but my lower body was absolutely untouched. So I had tons of energy. I was in no pain, but I couldn't watch TV and I couldn't read with double vision, really. So I just started walking, and I would walk in this little road around my house for like 3 hours at a time. And I just came up with this 5-book Rosemont series in my head. And then I started writing it. I published my first Rosemont, Coming to Rosemont, the first one in the series, in December of 2012. Under my maiden name, which was a pen name, so that if my writing was horrible, I wouldn't embarrass myself in the lawyer community.
And just tell us about the Rosemont series. So tell us what the setting was and what these stories were.
Yeah. So the Rosemont series, Rosemont is a stately manor home in the Midwest, and it is a supersized version of my own historic home, which kind of inspired some of the scenes, but my own home doesn't have 6 fireplaces and, you know, all that. So it's a story about a 55-year-old woman, forensic accountant, who loses her husband suddenly to a heart attack. That's bad. Finds out after he passed that he was embezzling from the college where he worked. Okay, that's worse. And then finds out he had a second family. Okay, that's all really bad. But he had inherited this stately manor home known as Rosemont, and had never told her about it. Okay, well, so now he's gone. It's hers. That's not so bad. She goes to see it. Basically, she's just going to put it on the market and sell it. But she's so curious about if she'll get some answers as closure on who this guy was that she'd been married to for many years and didn't know. And walks into Rosemont. The door shuts behind her. And she says, I am home. I'm going to stay here. That door shuts behind her. Scene is actually inspired in my own life because my husband and I bought this house. We got married in 2010 in this house. And when the door shut behind us, we're like, okay, we hadn't even walked through the house. And we're like, we're buying this house.
Yeah, which does happen.
We just knew.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does happen. And despite the fact that friends and family said, are you out of your minds? But we weren't, and we did. And that's Maggie's experience. And then a dog adopts her on her first night in Rosemont, like dogs do. And that leads her to the local veterinarian, who is their love interest. The town has a lot of fraud and political corruption, which was based upon a lot of research I did in middle-sized cities in the United States. This has been a problem. There's lots of corruption and embezzlement. I built in that kind of theme because she's a forensic accountant. She gets involved in that, and then the series goes. I was originally going to cap it off at 5 books, and the last one, Bringing Them Home, was just my little tie-it-all-up love story. And then I kept getting so many lovely emails from readers that we want more. And my author assistant, who is wonderful, said to me, Barb, what is the matter with you? People want to read more of these books. Why don't you write another book? I'm like, all right, well. So I've written two more now. The seventh book, Restoring What Was Lost, will be published in October. And so I've kind of taken her plot arc on in new directions, because I really didn't want this to be stale and for people to think, oh my God, you know, you've gone way beyond what you should have.
How would you describe them genre wise? It sounds like a bit of romance, bit of women's fiction, would you say? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Squirrely women's fiction. There is romance in them. There's mystery, thriller, suspense. And I've written some other mystery, thriller, suspenses recently, and I do well with that. They're probably lighter on the romance. If somebody is really a romance reader, they may be disappointed because it's not heavily into that and not into those tropes.
It's not firmly genre romance, but women's fiction, it fits
right
beautifully.
I get I cross too many genres, but I ignore that and soldier forth.
Well, yeah. I was just going to say, I'm just having a quick look on Amazon, and I can see that, you know, the first in the series, as you say, coming to Rosemont, which is 2013, is currently in the top 2,500 in the paid Kindle store. It's 65 in women's crime fiction, 38 in women's sagas. I mean, this is a book that's still selling very well. So we're going to, spoiler alert, this has been hugely successful for you, which we're very excited about.
So
how did that bit happen? How did writing the book turn into something that's clearly been a very good commercially successful career for you?
Well, yes, I think the largest single factor in it being successful has been paying attention to Mark's courses. Being a student, I watch every one of them at least once. I take notes and I apply. Now I'm big enough that I have somebody who does my ads and watches all that for me. But I know how to do it. So thanks to you guys, I know how to track the metrics. If I had to take it back on, I could. So it makes me competent to supervise it. And I think, as much as many writers don't want to, if you're going to be self-published and want to make money, then that's part of the deal.
Yeah, I think it's just worth pausing on that moment, because it's very important. I'm doing this now with our imprint. You've got to be competent yourself before you outsource to somebody else. Otherwise, you can't manage them. You can't manage the project and the program if you're just hoping, fingers crossed, that they know what they're doing. So you learn to inside out first. And you've got to the point now where you're comfortable with somebody else.
Yes, and I think they do it better than I do. Case in point, and I want to talk about my BookBub ads and something I did recently at the advice of Mark Dawson, which is why it's doing so well. But when I hired this company, one of the terms that they use in their Amazon ads was something, I'll get to it, I'll leave that as a spoiler, but was something I thought, this is crazy. This is absolutely nuts. Are you out of your mind? And so I was just all over them. And then, you know, we looked and dug into the results. Crazy. One of my most profitable terms, I don't think you'd guess it, is cat litter.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
Isn't that crazy? Would you ever in a million years think to try cat litter?
No. I mean, there's dogs on your covers, and you say dogs feature fairly heavily in the books, but that's random. Oh. Random.
Isn't that random?
So that was a search term that came up from, you know, you can look at the search terms people have used to find you. Was that how that came up?
I assume so. I think they use KDP and Klytics. They use a whole bunch of those. And that was one of the terms. And lo and behold, people searching for cat litter like to buy my books. So God love them.
Yeah.
So that's good to leave your mind open a little bit to someone else's expertise.
Yes.
One of the things that early on helped me, there were a couple things that launched my success. One was in July 4th, 2014. It was 2014. I was lucky enough to qualify for a BookBub ad for Coming to Rosemont. And I remember thinking, oh, it's so expensive. This is crazy. What am I doing? And I thought, oh, well, what the heck? Do it. And I did. And, you know, I just kind of went about my day and I'm running around doing stuff. And then in the evening, I checked to see how I'm doing. I'm number one in the entire Kindle store.
Wow.
The BookBub, my book was the first one that they put on there. I sold 10,000 books. Well, that's a life changer. Then I became one of the BookBub bestsellers. And when they do a blog on women's sagas, a couple of times my book, my series has been first. You just can't negate that.
Yeah.
But then, of course, BookBub would have none of me. For years and years, even though I asked most politely, they, you know, refused me because I'm on KDP Select.
Yeah.
And I think they really want you to be wide. I'm not going wide. But on August 9th, lightning hit again, and I did Coming to Rosemont for free, which I've never done. I've never wanted to do. I hate people getting stuff for free. Well, but I listened to your stuff. I've got a series. And starting that day, I mean, not only did I sell, I don't know how that's possible. I sold 150 eBooks of Coming to Rosemont on the day it was free. I had 60,000 downloads. And my reviews increased, and I've been selling about, for the rest of the series, I'll total about 150 copies a day since then. I realize in your terms, in your world, that's small. In my world, that's big.
Yeah. That's huge. Yeah. And did you then see, were you in KDP Select at that point?
Yes. Yeah.
So did you then see page reads going up in the weeks that followed with those 60,000 downloads?
Yeah. And interestingly, since I've been using this new marketing team, my print sales have gone up. I've tracked my percentage of sales for years. It's been about 85% ebook, 15% print, with 29%, between 29 and 30 every single solitary month from KU, my income. So that's kind of how my numbers have worked out. So I don't know as I would ever go wide.
No. So you had a BookBub, which was a big fillip for you in those early days. And then you started putting into practice in terms of the book writing, you had Coming to Rosemont, and then how quickly did you follow that up?
I believe the next year I did the next one, and I pumped out for the next 5 years. I did one a year while I was still working full time.
Okay.
When I thought I finished the series, then I did a couple of murder mysteries, and I did my recent book, but then I went back and I've written now two more of the Rosemont series.
Okay.
Oh, and I did my Christmas novella in there too.
Right. And your BookBub obviously was, as I say, a big fillip. Then was it Facebook ads you were running in those early days?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Facebook ads. And I was killing it. Thanks to Mark, I learned how to do it. And I was killing it with Facebook ads until a couple of... And I restarted them now because Amazon doesn't like just their own ads, which is enough to make you insane with these people. But anyway, for a couple of years, I just discontinued all Facebook ads because it didn't seem like they were working. But I knew that my base would be Facebook users. And so I had my author page, and to grow it, I followed the strategy from another company that said, set up a fan page, an independent fan page that you can draw eyes to, people who would be interested in your books, and then you can promote your books on that page and draw them over to your author page. So at that time, Downton Abbey was in its second season, and instead of, you know, they were advising me to, well, I love fiction, I love books, I'm like, no, too generic. Downton Abbey fans. So I started the Downton Abbey fans page. One of the best business decisions I've ever made. It's now like 150,000 likes. I get offers to buy it. I would never sell it because it's now it's easy. I've got so much content. We just roll it along. And it also has provided, it certainly has grown my author page to almost 40,000 likes. And I've got a private group I run of about 3,000 that's very active, sort of a street team. Other opportunities came to me. Cult Box UK, which was an online entertainment sort of source, contacted me because their Downton Abbey reviewer was in a car accident. This is on a Tuesday. They need a review for Thursday.
Right.
Can they send me a link and can I become their new reviewer? I got a full-time job. I say, of course I can, because that's what the hours between midnight and 3 a.m. are
yes,
for, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That, otherwise, you're just wasting those, aren't you, asleep.
Exactly. So I did that. What fun that was. I did that for the whole series. I did Home Fires. I did The Halcyon. I did The Crown. That website has been sold and I don't do that anymore, but.
And how do you, with this.
How many opportunities came?
This tangent Downton Abbey page, how do you then use that to get people to buy your book, to put it crudely?
Yeah. So when I have a new release, I just post it on the Downton Abbey page, fans page. I don't know how many book sales I get from that, but I certainly grew my author page and I get sales off of that.
Yeah.
And it's just fun. Certainly the exercise of writing reviews every week honed my skills as a writer, like probably no other experience would have been. Gave me some credibility. And now, like when they come out with a new Downton Abbey cookbook, which they do all the time, they have official cookbooks.
Yes.
People send it to me. And I get the free cookbook and I cook out of it and I post on it. And so it's been kind of a fun thing that now doesn't take much. I think it was more of a platform builder than a sailor, than something that sold books.
But I could see you've obviously got some business nous there, Barb, in terms of thinking a little bit outside of the regular, starting things that are vaguely related but not directly about sales, which I think some people struggle with that connection. They think they're sort of wasting their time if they're not directly selling their book. But it's worked incredibly well for you simply to build up a base of people who potentially are your market.
Yes, absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you're a lawyer rather than a selling services. Well, I suppose lawyers do sell services in a way, but I think you were in-house, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in-house. And so maybe that gave me a little more business savvy. And I think certainly the business aspect of being an independent author is a big part of it if you want to make money.
Yeah.
And that stuff's all in my wheelhouse. So that part is a little easier for me.
And what about the technical aspects of running Facebook ads, running Amazon ads, setting up your Facebook page? Did you have much experience in that area?
No, I had no experience. I had to learn it all. And there were a lot of mornings in my bathrobe at my kitchen counter, you know, either combination of swearing and crying. Because it wasn't easy for me. And I do have visual impairments. So that is difficult too. But one of my superpowers is I'm tenacious. And other people would say I'm stubborn. So I just kept going.
Did you spend and lose a lot of money in those early days? How long did it take you to start seeing
profits? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I did. you know, I hired some people that didn't work out. So that's expensive. But I always kept my eyes on my ads, and my ads turned out nothing was really a total, very few were a total disaster.
Okay.
So I was lucky with my graphics. Early on, I have sliders on my website, BarbaraHinsky.com, at the top that show my book on a table, pretty background, cup of coffee. They're beautiful, I think. I've used them in my ads. They've been wonderful. Back in the day, probably they'd be a little stale now, but.
So I can see behind you the Guiding Emily book. So you've moved on. Have you finished Rosemont, or will there possibly be more?
No. Yeah, there's one coming out in October, and now our heroine is in a different job. I don't want to do spoilers, but yeah, there'll be more of that. And that's just such a gentle, happy place. It'll be interesting to see. I wrote the seventh book this winter, summer, when I was myself craving comfort and community and connection. Mm-hmm. And I think that's reflected in the book, so I'll be anxious to see what my readers think.
So tell us about Emily Maine and this new series.
This book has my heart, and I'm going to actually reach up and show it close.
So if you're watching on YouTube, this is a beautiful Labrador, I'm going to say.
Yeah, this is a black lab. His name in the book is Garth. Oh. And Guiding Emily is the love story between Garth, a guide dog, and Emily Maine, his handler, who loses her eyesight on her honeymoon, and it's their journey together.
This book could have been written for my wife, word for word for my wife.
Really?
We've just brought up a guide dog puppy, and unfortunately we won't do it again because it broke our hearts to say goodbye to her, which of course is what you have to do. We had her for nearly 2 years, and she's now in advanced training. She's the most gorgeous. Yes. So it broke our hearts to lose Charlotte. But I tell you what, I will be buying this book immediately after this interview because my wife will adore it, I'm sure.
Good. The reviews have been stunning. And within the guide dog and the blind community, I have been overwhelmed with the reception.
Just on the reviews, I did notice that 184 reviews on the .com site, 90% 5-star. You don't see that very often. That's 4.9 out of 5. That's absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. I love this book. It's the first in the series. And if I can just talk a little bit about, can I say how it came about?
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
Yeah. So in February of 2019, I was at a library gala, and naming rights for a character in my next book were one of the live auction items. Emily Maine is the one who bought those rights, incidentally. And I was seated next to the development director for the Foundation for Blind Children in Phoenix, Arizona. The foundation is like a mile and a half from my house, and we're talking. And he said, "You've never been in here?" I'm like, "No." "Well, you and your husband come and take a tour next week." So we did. And I was so incredibly moved seeing what they do, their classrooms. They service children from 0 to 105, so they have a large adult population. And this little 4-year-old boy throws his arms around me, and he's just giggling like crazy. And the director said, you know, he was born deaf and blind in Canada, and his parents were told he would never walk, would never talk, and probably wouldn't live very long, just keep him comfortable. Well, his heartbroken parents refused to accept that, and they emigrated to the U.S. and enrolled him at the foundation, and there he was in my arms, walking and talking and living a bright future. So, of course, by then I'm full on. Like, I've lost it. I'm crying. And I said to Steve, "What do you need? What can I do to help?" And he said, "We need to raise awareness within the sighted community of the isolation that the visually impaired and blind feel. And we're a nonprofit. We need money." Well, I said, "Good. You know, I'm not a trust fund baby. I can't write you a check, but I'm an author. A book can do both of those things. So I'm donating half of my proceeds from Guiding Emily to the foundation And they were wonderfully supportive in my research. They gave me white cane training. I got to take that.
Well, did you actually blindfold yourself and walk with the dog? Yeah.
Yeah. They put you in goggles, and mine had a little pinprick of vision in the center, so I could actually see. But I'm telling you what, when we went outside with the white cane, I don't think I've ever had a panic attack before, but I did then. It was terrifying. So that was helpful to have. I was able to network my way into Guide Dogs for the Blind in California and spent 3 days behind the scenes, seeing things what people like you do. And so I did not want to victimize the visually impaired. I wanted to honorably portray their journey. There are a lot of fictional blind people, and they're not always very admirable. Alcoholics and promiscuous and drug dealers. And, you know, this community wanted somebody that is living life like we all do, with courage and not limited by their blindness. So in order to, you know, Emily loses her sight on her honeymoon, there's obviously this big period of devastation and depression. This book would have been very heavy and depressing if I didn't intersperse it with chapters written from Garth's perspective. And he is funny, and he is light and lovely, and I think elevates the book. So, obviously, this book is really close to my heart.
Yes, I can tell that. Labradors are the best. So that's we have a pet Labrador as well. A Goldie, though, not black, but he looks a very, very handsome boy. Okay, so if you're watching on YouTube, we'll go onto Amazon and check out Guiding Emily. That's a gorgeous, gorgeous cover, by the way. How did that come about?
You know, everything about this has been fairly easy. So think of that. February 2019, I get the idea. I'm still working full time. I retired from the practice of law in July, spent a week on set on the movie that my novella was made into, and then started writing Guiding Emily. And plus I had to do all this research, white cane training, go to Guide Dogs for the Blind, all this. Everything fell in place. So I started thinking about the cover, and I thought, I really want a dog's face on the cover. The black lab came from a friend's guide dog. His name is Miyoki. So that's what it's based upon. And I wanted to ask you, so what, the puppy you trained, was it a lab as well?
It was a cross between a Labrador and a Golden Retriever.
Which is fabulous.
Which they do. And they breed their own dogs, and they have quite a few labs, quite a few retrievers, and quite a few crosses, and a few German Shepherds as well.
Yeah.
But she was absolutely gorgeous. She had a lot of that retriever kindliness, that sort of generous character, but quite a lot of nous as well, which you get with a Labrador. Well, they're very food orientated, so they do things for food.
Yeah, and that's why Garth has an affiliation or an affinity for crunchy Cheetos in the book.
Yes, of course.
So I just, literally this cover took half an hour.
Wow.
I didn't design it, but I looked on Shutterstock for pictures. On the second page was this picture. I said, okay, I think I'm done.
Yeah. There you are. Well, it looks gorgeous. It's quite striking as well. Well, look, best of luck with that book, particularly as the proceeds are going to such a worthy cause. We're in that position now where we want Charlotte to do well and to pass and become qualified. But if she doesn't, there's a possibility she comes back to live with us. So the children are crossing their fingers she's going to fail because we want her to pass. That's the whole point of doing it.
You know, what a wonderful thing, as you well know, when I was at a graduation ceremony at Guide Dogs for the Blind, there was a man, I would say in his 50s, he was an executive at, I think, Apple. So he had a big job, and, you know, he presented himself as somebody who had a big job. And it was so touching. He said he couldn't wait to go to work on Monday because now, he said, maybe with the dog, I'll make some more friends at work.
Wow. Oh, that's heartbreaking, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. And so
the difference these dogs make to people's lives is incredible. Yeah. You have to see it to believe it, really do.
That's a beautiful thing you did.
Yeah, thank you. Well, my wife did it mainly, but we broke all our hearts. Barbara, now you mentioned in passing that one of your books has been adapted into a film, into a Hallmark film, yes. which has been out.
Yes.
So just tell us how that happened.
So I wrote The Christmas Club, I want to say 2016, based upon a loose homily from a sermon I had heard in church 30 years ago, with the point being doing kind things, but do them in a nice way. I set this in 1952 in Cleveland, and woman comes out of the bank, her purse falls and opens, and her Christmas club money flies out, $6, $5 bills. Christmas clubs at the time, if you don't have them where you are, where you'd go in and put money down in an account all year long, and then at Christmas you take the money out with your interest, and they'd usually give you a toast or a little gift, something like that. So her Christmas club money flies to the wind. A gentleman sees her fall, helps her up, helps her back into the bank, and a woman, they help her in the bank, and he says, well, what did you lose? You know, $6, $5 bills. She'd worked all year for that. And he says, well, I'll go see if I can find it. Of course, the money's gone. He goes out, opens his wallet. He has five fives. And he said, all right, well, I'll tell her I found five fives. And the woman follows him out. She has one five. They pool their money and give it to the old lady so that she feels like, you've done me a kindness, but you haven't treated me like a charity case. And then the $5, each of the $5 bills gets found by somebody who does something kind with it. So it's got a very kind heart, this little book, 20,000 words. And from the get-go, people said, this would be great on Hallmark. And I thought, you know what, I think it would be. I didn't know anybody at Hallmark, but I just started asking every single person who I came in contact with, do you know anybody at the Hallmark Channel? And finally, somebody said, well, my neighbor at the cabin produces Good Witch, which is their most successful franchise. Do you want me to give him a copy? I'm like, well, yeah, put the phone down and run a copy next door right now. Of course I want you to give him a copy. And from there, it went. It just went. He loved it. He was going to acquire it and took it to Hallmark. And they decided that they wanted to acquire it, which they do when they evidently, if they think it's got the possibility of a series or a sequel. So they acquired the rights. That was nice for me because Hallmark paid double what I was going to get from him. So there it is. And it filmed last summer in Winnipeg and was on the Hallmark Channel this November and December.
The November, December just gone. It's debuted, I mean. I know you don't necessarily become a millionaire from these deals, particularly with a high turnover of production that Hallmark have to have. But you would say this has been a venture very worthwhile for you.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. You don't get rich. I mean, so many people think, oh my gosh, now you can, you know. No, you don't. Has it built my platform? Absolutely. Was it fun? Yes. Is it so much fun to look at the TV and see on the screen based on the book by Barbara Hinsky? I've got a framed still shot of that. Wow. I held a big party at my house. We hauled all the furniture out of the first floor and had a big viewing party to celebrate it. That was fun. So in addition to all the bragging rights and fun and, you know, stuff that you can put on things, I also treated it as a business opportunity. The Hallmark Channel gets a ton of publicity for their countdown to Christmas. So my assistant and I, she's a great researcher, we contacted every single solitary publication that published the movie schedule and asked if they wanted to interview me. 95% of them did. I spent a month practically hardly getting out of my pajamas and no time for a shower. Practically, because I did hundreds of interviews. I was interviewed in Reader's Digest and Good Housekeeping Magazine, all of that. And I would always mention Guiding Emily, and they'd say, get back to me when you publish that. And I did. I was on the local television twice. I've been on the television with Guiding Emily. And so I used that to parlay this next book. And when I was in Winnipeg, for filming, I went for a week of filming I thought maybe, you know, my husband went with me and I thought, okay, you know, he's probably going to be bored. So maybe we'll go a couple of days. We went every day. It was so much fun. They treated us so well. But I went with probably 5 rehearsed pitches in case I had an opportunity to pitch them to anybody. I wrote them out, I said them in the mirror, and I memorized them because I don't know, I'm very good off the cuff on that. You know, I was a little starstruck with all of that. And don't you know, I had an opportunity to pitch every single solitary thing, and they all landed well. In fact, I went back and did another couple pitches because I thought, well, I'm out of ammo. Let's see what I can do. So I guess I don't think this comes naturally to most authors, and it didn't to me. I work with a life coach who's a business coach.
Right.
And he said, Barb, what do you got prepared to pitch? And I'm like, well, nothing really. I don't know. And he said, well, that's ridiculous.
I think you're right. I think some authors will be listening to this thinking it's just not them because they're introverts by nature. But there's a way of treating it in a business sense, rehearsing. And if you've got something to say to somebody because you've thought about this opportunity, that's a little bit different from having to make polite conversation, which is actually what fills most of us with horror in that environment. So you had a purpose to your travels to Winnipeg to visit a location.
Absolutely. And I didn't have to like shoulder my way in with these pitches. The first time I met our executive producer, John Esquinas, I'm shaking his hand in the little bake shop scene. By the way, we got, my husband and I got cameos.
Superb.
Yeah, which was fun. Yeah, so that was fun. But he said to me, he said, so what else have you got for me? We need to work together again.
So you didn't even have to ask him.
No, it's a good thing I was prepared, isn't it?
Yeah.
Instead of just going, wow.
Have those elevator moments ready. What fun and how brilliant to have that made for you, have that film made. And in terms of the film itself, how much did it change from your book? How much was your dialogue? And were you happy with the way that the screenwriters had adapted it?
I was thrilled with the screenplay. It was just lovely. And there were some things I wish I had thought of, but it's completely different. It's set current day and it's Hallmark. They focus on a love story. Whereas my book didn't focus so much on the love story, but on the kind of pay it forward, random acts of kindness thing.
Right.
They were both wonderful. Honestly, I think the book is a little more profound, but it was wonderful. I think they did a great job. I was proud of it. Sitting in the video village with everybody, you got a headphone on and they're treating you like a big deal. It's really crazy. And at one point, I looked over at my husband and we're both like teary because they're saying on the screen words from the book.
That you wrote, yeah.
You just can't imagine how that feels. Well, you probably can, but it's so much fun to see that.
Superb. And in terms of your career, Barbara, can you give us an idea of, you don't have to give us precise figures, but what sort of difference this has made to your life?
Oh, well, certainly it's made a difference. Couple of things. The connection to readers has been so satisfying, so much more satisfying. And I had a great legal career and I'm proud of it. And I love the people I worked with and I love the work I did. And I still do some things on a consultant basis. But this is so much different. My brand is encouraging, comforting, uplifting fiction. And so to get that response from my reader group is just everything. So there's that aspect of it. I'm making a difference in people's lives, which is what I wanted to do. In terms of money, as you know, it's so interesting. I'm sure everybody can relate. You go to a wedding reception or something, family gathering, it's like, oh, well, you're doing what you love. And you just get patronized all over the place. Mark's big enough. He doesn't get that anymore, but I'm sure he did in the beginning. And okay, well, yeah, I am doing what I love, but it's also, make no mistake, it's hard work. This is a lot of hard work. Even when you love doing it, there's a lot of commitment. And so I've sold in my series well over 100,000 books And instead of the 17 cents a book, I'm getting, you know, $3+ a book for a hobby. That's like real money, huh?
That is proper real money. That's lawyer money, Bob.
Yeah, that's lawyer money. It's good money. And, you know, I want to encourage people just to do what I did. Ask people with Guiding Emily. I've decided that I think Emma Stone would be perfect as the actress for Emily. Emma Stone is from Phoenix. I started asking around, does anybody know Emma Stone's mother? I picked her mother because Elizabeth Mitchell was the actress in The Christmas Club. It was her first Hallmark movie. And she's known for Lost, and she kind of plays a badass character. So this was different. And she said, well, her mother read The Christmas Club and called her up and said, Elizabeth, have your agent find out if somebody's bought the screen rights. And if they have, I want you to get a part in that. So mothers have influence. So I started asking around everybody. Does anybody know Emma Stone's mother? Okay. I finally get a yes. And I find out who her production company is. I've been in contact with them, and they're presenting it to Emma.
Wow.
She may not do it, but if I hadn't been out there at the grocery store, at Costco, at the pharmacy, wherever, Costco, yapping about, does anybody know? You'd be surprised. So don't hesitate to ask people. People like to help you, particularly if they have a connection they can make.
And no one's going to help you if you don't ask.
Yes.
So this is
always no.
Not so much about taking opportunities, which is one thing. This is about creating opportunities. I think the message from you is go out there and create them. And leverage once it happens. Make sure that you make the most of it. But it's actually making those things happen for you rather than waiting for them to happen to you.
Yeah. But don't be afraid to do things. And everything isn't successful for me. I decided with my Hallmark movie, I would take out a banner ad. No other authors had done that on the web page that the Hallmark Channel had for their movie. So that was $5,000.
Wow.
That's a lot of money. But they designed the ad for me. They were so nice to me. And I thought, well, what greater congruence than the book to the movie?
Yeah.
What I didn't realize was that all the good ad time was taken up by Campbell's Soup because they had casserole was sponsored placement. Okay. Well, I don't think I sold one single book. That was $5,000. That's a hard lesson.
Yeah.
So I don't always get it right for sure.
But you took the chance and yes.
But I take chances.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Barbara, it's quite inspiring listening to you. And I've actually bought the paperback version here in the UK. So there'll be an Amazon printer whirring somewhere now, printing that off for the next couple of days.
Yeah,
and my wife will read it and I'll read it after her. I want to say congratulations on your career. I know that you've credited Mark and his teaching. So we shall say thank you to Mark, me as well, because I'm learning from him all the time as well. And I know it's made you said yourself, it's made a significant difference to you, which is wonderful. But we're, you know, in the same way that you do things for your readers, we're absolutely thrilled when people come to us and say, thank you, because it's made a difference to me. So great. And bigger and better things. I can't wait to see the Guiding Emily movie with Emma Stone.
Yeah. I'm hoping it's also being considered by another big company.
Yeah, I was going to say, if Emma doesn't do it for whatever reason, who knows where that's going to lead, that process that you've started in these scripts. Sometimes scripts do, and you do hear some big films, they were knocking around as scripts under various people for 15 years before somebody said, let's do this now. Who knows? Brilliant. Bob, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for having me. One of these years, I'm going to get to one of your events. And if you see this crazy lady coming at you with her arms wide, just don't. I'm going to be hugging
both of you. We're going to hug it up when we meet each other. And next time we're in Phoenix, we have been to Phoenix actually on our travels. I hadn't realized you were basically, we have. Yeah, we went there last year, I think. John and I did an interview very nearby. Actually in Phoenix, yeah. So
we'll get together
next
then.
Next time we will make sure that we come and see you. Superb.
For sure.
Bob, thank you so much indeed.
Thank you. It was a thrill.
This is the Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go. We talk a lot, don't we, Mark? People who have books optioned and discussions go on, and I know there's been interest in your books and they're bubbling away in the background. It's not that often we speak to an author who's had their film made, and Barbara's been on the set of a film, listening to actors saying the words that she wrote, or after they've been through several drafts, no doubt, for the screenplay, which must be quite a exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be. Yeah, that's one thing I would certainly down tools to, you know, jump on a plane to wherever something was being shot to see a film being made. That would be great. So that is certainly one of the things that I think authors most would like to see happen is seeing a book make it to TV or film. Might have some news on that soon, but we'll have.
Oh, okay. Now, you probably can't answer this for contractual reasons, but I was thinking that it would be sensible for an author, any author, trad or indie, to get the first film made. I wouldn't worry. Personally, people worry, oh, how much should I be? You know, what's a fair amount for this? And how can I make sure I'm not going to be ripped off? And I think surely the benefits of having your name attached to a film outweigh whether you get $10,000 or $40,000 in that first payment. You'd almost do it for free, allow them to make that book into a film because of the potential long-term benefits of being discovered as an author.
It's a little bit naive. I know where you're getting at. It's a bit more complicated than that. I mean, I can't talk about numbers. I have just signed a deal in December. Maybe we'll do a podcast about it later on. But my view on that is, although in principle, giving the rights away for 12 months as a free option, you know, I can see why you might want to do that. But my counter to that is, I like my partners to have skin in the game. So in the same way that when I was traditionally published, I was always pushing for a slightly larger advance, even though an advance is just technically an advance on royalties. It's just kind of money up front. And there are consequences if you don't earn that back, as I didn't the first two books. I think for something like this, with a film, I want them to feel that they have invested fairly heavily in the IP, and then that's something that I think would serve as good motivation to actually get something made so they can make that money back again. There is a benefit. Yeah. I'm not greedy on those scores, because there's definitely a benefit, a significant one, to having a film out there that based on books. You'll sell more books.
And I'm definitely not in favor, by the way, of this culture of organizations saying, oh, can you design this poster for our restaurant, and we'll give you some, give you some coverage, we'll give you a mention on our Instagram feed in return. Yeah, well, that's not going to pay your bills. I'm completely against that culture. But this is one instance where having a film made with your name on it just seems to me there is a benefit there. And to getting that first one done, then you can start.
But also, you're right. I think films, they don't get made, right? You talk to an agent and ask them the number of options that they've sold compared to the number of films that are actually made from those options, the percentage would be very small. For the author who has bills to pay, I understand the point in terms of publicity, but that's an IP right that can be sold. So, very commercial.
Yes, and as well. They do get made. And there's that thing going around with the Queen's Gambit producer saying that, which is a Netflix, a fantastic Netflix series, a 1980s novel. But I mean, that has been knocking around for years. And you can see, once you've watched the series, everything makes sense. It's really brilliant. But I'd be very interested in that original pitch meeting in a TV network, or back in the 80s, Hatchett or whoever it was who first published it, when a guy says, "Well, I'm going to write a book about..."
Is it Hatchett?
Hatchett. Steak Hatchett. Well, they're all going to be one soon, aren't they? To come up with a new name. Just saying that was going to be the content of the book, but it got made because some visionary people. There you go. I can't wait to see a Dawson based on the novel by...
Well, you never know. There's certainly some things happening.
You never know. Good. Okay. I should have said right at the beginning that you can learn more about ads for authors by going to selfpublishingformula.com/ads for authors. Everything you need to know will be on that page for you to make a good decision about that. And you can drop us an email, of course, or there's a chat box on that page. You can chat sometimes to me and Mark, and sometimes to Catherine and John and others, and get some answers to your questions. Good. I think that is it, Mark. It's dark here, which is why I'm eerily lit in blue.
Same here.
But the days are getting longer.
I know, thank God.
And thank Britain goodness. Has just passed 2.4 million vaccine jabs, which is something to think about.
Yeah, my dad's got his on Thursday. So
has he? Oh, that's great. My dad is 90 next month and still hasn't got his, but we're in a very low infection area, so I don't know if they're shipping them off to...
And your dad's not in a care home, so...
No, yeah, absolutely. They're prioritising people in care homes. Okay, right, enough of the pandemic. That's it, I think, for this week. Thank you very much indeed to Barbara Hinsky for being our fantastic interviewee, and well done on writing a glorious book there, Guiding Emily. Thank you, Mark. All that remains for me to say is it's a goodbye from him.
And a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.